This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity. I'm Pat Hazel. My guest today is a proper playwright and a busy screenwriter with many projects in development. Her plays have been produced by the Roundabout Theater Company, the National Theater, Playwrights Horizons, and the La Jolla Playhouse. She is currently collaborating with Stephen Schwartz on the new musical, The Queen of Versailles, set to star Kristen Chenoweth. Stay tuned for my conversation with the author of Ugly Lies the Bones, Aiming the Orphans, and Flat Earth, the scribe of stage and screen, Lindsay Ferrantino.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, you're captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la. La la la.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I can't believe you have the time to even have this conversation. How do you keep all of the projects between plays and screenplays going? I think most people would be curious how you can leap from one story to the next. Are you concentrated at one at a time, or are you obligated to be advancing everything at once?
Definitely obligated to be advancing everything at once. I went to grad school for playwriting, and I think when I was in grad school, we wrote usually about a play a semester, and that was all you were working on. And then at the end of the semester, you would switch to a new play. And I think at the time, I remember my classmates and I going like, that's so much writing. How can anyone just switch between projects like that? And I think the part that I didn't realize about being a professional writer is I'm often juggling 10 projects at once, and that muscle has just had to get stronger over the years because things take so long to actually get produced, or they're in development for so long. I just turned in a draft of a movie yesterday that I've been working on since 2018 in different iterations. If you could start something, finish it, and turn it in, and it would get made, you could work one project at a time. But because everything takes so many years of development, I think you always have to be working on many, many, many things and keeping a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, sometimes a project will take 7 to 10 years. And they, in some ways, think you're toiling over it for all those years.
Yeah.
But you're not. You're often waiting on decision or casting or money or...
Absolutely, yeah.
What's the mystique of being a playwright to you? What does that word playwright mean?
I just had a meeting yesterday where someone was talking about being a playwright and the spelling of the word playwright, the G-H-T in it rather than the W-R-I-T-E, and how that actually makes it both a noun and a verb, and how it's not just the act of writing, but of wrestling with something and making it come out, wrestling with an idea and something that you're observing in the world or thinking about in your personal life, and then finding a story and characters to be the right dramatic vehicle for that bigger idea that you've been thinking about.
Yeah, you're building and birthing something. So I guess when I hear playwright, I think more like shipwright, somebody who's crafting and building something and making it so specifically work so that it floats.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
Because you're young, and I mean this as the highest compliment, but you're in your mid-30s, right? You're around 36?
35.
You have done a lot of playwriting, and you're prolific, but also you take on some subjects that are not light. They're dramatic, and it's quite an impressive depth that you work with in your work. Many years ago, I was at a producers conference at the Eugene O'Neill. They assigned us two things. There was a musical track and there was a play track, and we were going to watch these two readings, and we were going to then lay out a promotional plan or talk about how this would be done. And the play that I saw was Ugly Lies the Bone, which was your play. And it was beautifully read and presented outside underneath a tree.
So beautiful. The O'Neill is just the most magical place.
It was so extraordinary, but it was a super deep play that included some post-traumatic stress syndrome and a burn victim. But playwriting, particularly a dramatic play, is not taken on that much now because of what musicals do in terms of revenue and in terms of a play that might play in New York on Broadway, where I saw Doubt and Wit and some of those plays. They don't go on the road really the same way because people just don't want to sit down and get into Death of a Salesman on their weekend. So I guess I wonder, did you grow up observing the world with this lens of drama?
No, not really. Well, my dad is a comedy magician. My mom doesn't work in the arts, but is a big arts appreciator. So, you know, I definitely went to theater as a kid. We lived half in New York, half in Florida. So I remember the first show I ever saw. And most people my age, the first Broadway show they ever saw was Cats. That was like the go-to. But as a kid, it actually was this really magical experience where I was really little when I saw it. And I didn't quite understand, like, were they cats? Were they people? Why were they so big? Why was I so small? They like crawled across the audience. I remember being like profoundly confused by it and sort of thrilled. And
No, it makes me laugh so much. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I can tell you why you were profoundly confused. First of all, it has every magical element of theater you can imagine.
Yes.
With costumes and makeup and lighting and fanfare and music. And what it doesn't have is a story that you can follow, or you have no idea why these cats came together. Now, as a grown-up, I know that it was based on a book of poems about cats where the rights of the family said, yeah, you can have it, but you can't change anything.
Yes.
It wasn't intended to be a musical or a play. It's basically a character study of a parade of cats in a fashion show.
Yeah. Well, as a kid, you don't need the story. You just need the costumes and the theatricality. It's funny to say, but I've talked to a lot of other playwrights who saw Cats at a young age, and it was like actually a both scarring and thrilling experience of just going like, what is this? What is theater? What does that mean? And then my dad being a comic magician, I feel like I grew up in the back of comedy clubs where he was performing. I would sometimes get to go with him, or when he was working cruise ships, we'd get to go and be in these theaters. And frankly, seeing a lot of cruise ship shows, I was just loved watching performances. And so that always leads you to being an actor, which I went to school for being an actor. So I'm not really answering your question, but I don't think I walked around with a dramatic lens on the world, but like a deep appreciation and fascination with the audience performer relationship, especially I think my dad being a magician and me knowing how all of his tricks worked, but watching the audience fall for them night after night and being just amazed by that and feeling like I got to be like in on the secret. I liked that feeling. Yeah.
A playwright is, in a way, as a storyteller, is using these things like misdirection to create a scenario that keeps us interested with a certain amount of tension until it resolves, which is ultimately where they find the card or they restore the rope. There's nothing but obstacles until the ta-da happens.
Yeah, which is like very similar, I think, to a play structure. Actually, I never thought about that before, but like the structure of a magic trick of presenting you with something, there being a mystery, and then like a result of that mystery is very similar to play structure or how we just take in stories.
So was it in being a student of playwriting that you began to take on the notion of topics like in Flat Earth, you address a middle school shooting and in some of these other things that are really quite a dramatic thing for people to have to face at that moment?
I came to that later. I think there was a lot of years of trying to figure out what I wanted to write about, which is, I think, pretty typical for all writers. You might be able to write, which I was always able to write. I wrote short stories and poems and then screenplays growing up and then in high school. And then in college, was still figuring out what my voice was. And I was copycatting a lot of plays that I really admired. Edward Albee was someone that I was obsessed with very early on. And so after I read his plays, I was writing a lot of absurdist Beckett type copycat plays. And then I realized I was interested in realism, but I was writing maybe things that were in the genre of realism, but weren't really my experience. I think it's a lot of years of trying to figure out. I have many plays that I've written that aren't will never see the light of day before you actually get to Ugly Lies the Bone, which was my first professionally produced play. And having wonderful teachers throughout those years, the playwright Tina Howe had run the grad program at Hunter College that I was in. I did two grad programs back to back, but she was the first really big playwriting teacher that I had. And I studied abroad in London for playwriting and had an incredible playwriting teacher, Roy Kendall, in London. And I just think that these teachers try to get rid of all of your copycat tendencies and go like, who are you? What do you care about? What stories do you want to see on stage that you don't normally see? And the more specific you can write, actually, the more universal it ends up being. A lot of people can write, but what can you individually bring to the table?
Yeah, I think that being derivative is often something that you do in the beginning, whatever field you're in. I saw comedians all my life that would imitate Jerry Seinfeld or imitate somebody else because there's a tone and a style to the way they observe the world. But it is a very tricky thing to find your own voice because there's a vulnerability in taking risks to say things that you think or you feel and wonder if anybody cares. You have the advantage as a playwright to put that in the mouths of your characters. But do you dare take on a topic or do you dare have an argument between those characters, which will then be critiqued, reviewed, and applauded or not? I really love playwrights because playwriting, it's almost like poetry in that you can be assured you're not going to make a mortgage payment as a playwright.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be like saying, hey, I want to work at that little diner where I made $5 in tips a night. And at the exact amount of time, you could be working at the Ritz-Carlton and serving that. But you go, I kind of like that quaint diner where nobody comes in. And I hope I'm flattering you with this romantic notion, but you've been very successful. You are in a top percentage of playwrights that make money from it. But it is a unbelievably honorable profession to lay the foundation of a play alone over a lot of time and many years. You are laying brick that you hope somebody will come along and want to present. There's often not a water cooler for that playwright. They're at home doing the work.
I think grad school for me was that sort of water cooler. And I did it twice. So I did 5 years of grad school after 4 years of undergrad. So between all of that schooling, I had a number of collaborators, writers whose work I was watching progress along with mine. You have a sort of accountability. You have to show up every week to read pages aloud, sometimes with actors. The grad schools often give you productions of the plays that you're working on. So it wasn't for me, at least in the beginning, as isolating as I think it can be for many people. But also the great part about playwriting versus screenwriting or TV writing is that all you really need is some people to read it out loud. And that can take many forms. If you're lucky enough to get an off-Broadway or Broadway production, obviously that's the dream. But often I would just have friends over to my apartment to read pages that I was working on. Writers groups function in that way. Whereas I actually find writing screenplays and TV, I think once they get made, it's more collaborative because there's so many people on set. But the process of developing it is actually much more isolating because you're just getting notes on your writing, but you aren't gathering weekly to hear it out loud. It's not like a living thing until it's produced.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation because in development, a play is always living and breathing.
Yes.
And there's always a conversation about it. And I find that even when you move from one venue to the next, you can improve it 5%, 10%, change something, adjust a character, put a new song in. But once you make a television show, it's done. Or you make a movie, you look at it and you go, oh, I wish I hadn't have done that.
Even just the act of writing it. But I think with playwriting, there are so many wonderful places like the O'Neill development programs that allow you to have conversations about what you're working on. Whereas the screenplay stuff, Maybe if you're lucky, you have producers or studio attached, but a lot of people just write screenplays on spec, and there isn't the same sort of culture of developing and talking about the work and finding your voice and all of that.
And you mentioned collaborating with other students and other folks moving in the theater. And yeah. Let's just talk about that collaborative process, because even now you're working with someone, you're writing a book for the musical where they're writing the music and lyrics. It's a construction site. Your job is the book writer, which I think most people don't really know what the book of a musical is. It is the structural story and the written word.
Yes.
And so you have to lay a foundation that's sound for all of those songs to come and go and all those high and low moments. And you have to have a certain amount of economy, because there's not so many pages to tell the story for the book writer.
In a musical, I used to think that the book writer was just responsible for the scenes between the songs. Whereas actually now that I'm working on musicals, you realize that the writer of the book is responsible for the story structure. Some of the musicals that I've written, I write the whole thing out as a play. We did that with Queen of Versailles. Stephen Schwartz is very generous in that way to allow me to sort of write the whole musical as a play, including places where we both sort of thought songs would go. I would often write those as a monologue, and then he would turn that into a song. Sometimes he would say, I need a bit more raw material here, or what is this character saying? Just the musical thing is so much more collaborative than anything I've ever worked on before. And the rewriting process is sort of insane when you realize just how many drafts of something there is. I just had no idea how much work it takes. It seems obvious because I heard it a lot, but until I was in it, just how much writing is rewriting. And the same for the composer and lyricist. There are many songs that were written that didn't ultimately end up in the show, or a piece ended up in the show and then he rewrote the whole thing, but the chorus stayed. It's just this constant process of revisiting the same material, figuring out what the audience is responding to, writing to that, tracking these characters. It's really, really satisfying, but it's a lot of work.
And you're working with an extraordinary composer and lyricist who's very clever and who understands the dynamic of making it move like a freight train.
He's incredible. He's the GOAT, as they say, like the greatest of all time. I mean, he really is. I grew up listening to his music, Pocahontas, Hunchback, Pippin, Children of Eden, Godspell. I mean, it's insane. When you're in a collaboration with someone, you are often battling it out and disagreeing, and that's all part of a healthy process. We were working the other day all day, and then in the evening, I got to go to a concert of his of Children of Eden, where there was 350 singers at Lincoln Center. He has like an encyclopedic knowledge of not just his musicals, which defines so much of the musical theater canon, but of all musicals. He's just a great appreciator of the form, has much deeper knowledge of musical theater structure than I do. So I think the collaboration has been interesting because I come from much more of a playwriting background and he's classic musical theater. So I think that tension of classic structure and me not knowing structure has made for a really interesting musical, I think.
I'm excited to see it for many reasons, but I do think that when I grew up, we're talking about Rodgers and Hammerstein days, there were things that were built on the songs alone, and the story sometimes was incidental between these, and so it wasn't as sturdy overall. It's almost like children's books that were beautifully illustrated and the story just was stuck in there. That's how musicals felt in the 50s. And you know, yeah. When I look back and I go, oh, that's a great song. Oh, that's a great song. Because they knew how to write songs. But often those teams didn't have a book sense.
Yeah.
And I think now what's interesting is not only are the books stronger for musicals, but also the musical elements are sustained throughout, where it's not just talking, singing, they come and go with each other, and there's beds of music, and they continue as the sets move on. There's no pause for 10 seconds to roll out a big building.
That's been the great benefit of working with a director early on in Queen of Versailles, because we have had the full team from the beginning before anything was written. It was myself, Michael Arden, who's a fantastic director, and Steven Schwartz, and our producer right from the beginning. So once the team was assembled, we met weekly on Zoom to just talk through what we thought the story was, just brainstorming an outline over and over again, over honestly many months before anything was written. And then we all gathered in a house for the week to really fine-tune the outline even more. And having a director in on those early conversations is so incredible because he's looking for completely different things than we are. We're looking at story, and he's also looking at story, but he's looking at, we need time for a costume change there, or how are we going to jump to that scene? And you're just thinking about it as a living, breathing, three-dimensional piece rather than just something written on a page.
Yeah, and this is Queen of Versailles, which is based on the movie, which is based on a true story.
Yes. It's a documentary. It's based on a documentary.
Yeah. But there was never a book in between. There was just the documentary.
The documentary, yeah. By Lauren Greenfield, who's an incredible documentary filmmaker. She's both a documentary filmmaker and a photographer who really chronicles American culture and the culture of wealth in just an incredible, incredible way. And I was obsessed with the documentary when I saw it years and years ago, and always thought it would make a brilliant musical. And it was my back pocket idea for many years, and tried talking to lots of producers about it. Everyone thought the rights were going to be too difficult to get because you would need the film rights and all of the life rights of all of the family. And we just didn't think that that was ever going to happen. And I kept bringing it up. And our amazing producer, Bill Damaschke, got really excited by it as well. And was like, let me see if I can get into it. At the same time, I had started to befriend the Siegel family and the filmmakers, and the team kind of came together in a very organic way, but it took a really long time to find the right people to do it with.
Okay, so now I'm so impressed by the ambition that you spearheaded this. So how then did Steven Schwartz join the team?
Okay, so the producer and the director came on about the same time. The producer was a meeting set up by my agents, and he happened to get really excited about it. Bill is incredible, and he was like, this sounds like a great idea. Let me look into it. At the same time, I was sat next to Michael Arden at a dinner hosted by the National Theater. I had never met him before, but was a great fan of his work. And he also said, what's the craziest idea for a musical that you have? I said, Queen of Versailles. And he was like, oh my God, we should do that. He happened to know Bill, the producer. And Michael had been the Hunchback in The Hunchback of Notre Dame when it was produced on stage. He was an actor first. And he had, from many different projects, a good friendship with Steven Schwartz. And Steven was also looking for a project to do with Kristen Chenoweth. Kristen was looking for a project with Michael. So it took a long time, but it's sometimes the best things are worth waiting for. And we approached Steven about it. He watched the documentary. He was like, I'm not sure this is for me. We took almost another year to get the rights actually sorted. We went back to him one more time. We said, just double checking before we move on that you are sure you don't want to do this with us. And he rewatched it, and something had changed in him and in the culture. He felt like over the previous year and felt like, actually, yeah, this is a story I want to tell.
Well, that's an important part of it. Especially as much time and energy that gets invested by the collaborators, you have to want to lose sleep over it because it's going to be in your life a long time.
A really long time.
Yeah. Now, it's set to have its pre-Broadway world premiere July 16th coming up. And are you feeling like you're headed there with no problem? Are you feeling super excited about it? Or are you like, okay, we got to really dig in now?
I feel prepared.
Good.
I'm actually just eager to get it in front of an audience, and you don't know if something works until you have an audience. We have had so many workshops because Bill is a genius producer, and he really always believes in trying to get the thing on its feet as many times as possible. And we've had audiences of maybe about 60 people at some of those workshops. So we have a taste of how an audience is responding to it, but we won't really know until we get it in front of a big audience with the set and the costume. So I feel like we have done a lot of work, many workshops, many notes. I just feel excited. I've never had something produced of this scale before. So I just kind of can't wait to get in the room.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's kind of like having a garage full of fireworks and you get to the opening, you light the fuse and just sit back. The writing process is one thing. And you wrote the play, Aiming the Orphans, and now you're writing the screenplay and set to direct. And how far along are you in that process? And have you done a lot of directing of film work or just plays?
I have not directed my own plays, but the role of a playwright in a room, you really work very closely with the director. And the way that plays are structured, you have say over casting and hiring of designers and working with actors. And Amy and the Orphans is a play that I wrote about my own family. I had an aunt who had Down syndrome and wanted to write a play about my family's relationship with her. I developed it at Yale with this wonderful actress, Jamie Brewer, who starred in it at Yale and then started in the play when it was at Roundabout. And so I have worked with her for many years on developing this character. And because the play is so personal to my family, I just had the idea that I wanted to direct the film version and luckily found producers who agreed that I could do it. And so Jason Bateman's company Aggregate is producing the movie. We are in the sort of final stages of casting it. So we're hoping to make it this year. I can't say who is in the movie because it's not public yet, but
right. But I see you're smiling, so you know.
Yeah, it's exciting. These things take a long time and patience is key. And I have wonderful producers who have never given up on this project and we're still pushing it ahead, yeah.
Well, I think you're going to be an excellent director. And I will say, when you are writing a play, you are often directing it in, like you're telling when they're into, you're saying that they're crossing the credenza, they're picking up the phone, you're blocking it. Even though directors add a big element of creating the emotional conflict and all that. But this is the bonus of all that stuff we talked about in the beginning of how playwrights are in this thing in their head and in their room, which is that you are sitting down and taking dictation for the characters and deciding what's happening there. And in order for it to be interesting, you're having to cut out all the unnecessary parts. So in a weird way, you are writer, director, editor.
There are a number of playwrights that have made the transition successfully to directing. John Patrick Shanley. I won't go through the whole list, but it's a leap that's not too far, I think, to make. But I will say that Amy and the Orphans, I worked with an incredible director, Scott Ellis, when he directed the play in New York. And I think for that story, because it was so close to my family and to me, I think for the initial production of it and the world premiere, it was really good that I had a director and an outside eye to help me figure out the story. And he was essential in doing that. But now I feel like I sort of get what the story is and could certainly do the movie.
Yeah. And I wonder whether the sensitivity you had towards your aunt and growing up with that. Again, earlier I was asking, where does your sense of drama and conflict, but if that was one of your early plays, that makes sense to me that you could handle that kind of thing that was around you all the time.
I'm particularly interested in stories that are dramatic at its subject matter, but I think moment to moment are funny. And like life, one moment they're sad, one moment they're funny. I wouldn't classify my stuff as either dramas or comedies, really. It's somewhere in between. That's more for the marketing team to figure out how they're marketing it, the story. I think I'm always trying to write serious subjects with an unexpected tone, I think.
A sugar pill makes the medicine go down, as they say. If a play is presented as completely dramatic and intense, in some ways, it's a hard pill to swallow for the audience because they leave with a weight on their shoulders. But if there's a lightness or you find that humor, oftentimes your messaging is built right into the shot you stick in their arm.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think there's very few situations in life that are entirely dramatic or entirely comedic. People laugh at funerals and cry at weddings, and life tends to ricochet back and forth between the two things, I think.
It's not even just black humor in terms of the way people can look at something, but I think that you almost can't survive it without having a sense of humor. Being at my grandfather's memorial, and I was terrified to get up and speak because I came from comedy and I was afraid people would expect something. And And I was uncertain what I would say. And on the flight there, I just wrote a list of words on a magazine page that had an open space on it that were things that made me think of him that were unique.
Yeah.
So that was in my pocket folded up and I never followed through with it. And then my dad said something about having his son come up. And it was my other brother, but somebody said, oh, they nudged me like it was me. And I was like, oh, no. So I just went up and I said, I don't really have anything, but I'd like to read a list of things that made me think of him. And I read the list with no intent for humor.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it felt like a poem. And cribbage rhymed with cabbage. It was a completely accidental thing where they began to laugh. I was crying while I was reading it.
Yeah,
but somehow the magic of the two things together was uplifting for all of us. And also the list was just exactly who he was. So it didn't require the words in between.
Yeah, absolutely.
In writing from the heart or finding truth to write, which you're talking about these stories that have resonance or that make the challenge people, it often is the yin and yang of how do we survive it? And we all have to get over this wall together.
Yes, absolutely. Even Ugly Lies the Bone, which it's about a burn survivor, female veteran coming back from Afghanistan in extreme pain. When I was researching that role and talking to veterans and talking to people in that level of pain, the sense of humor is the only thing that kind of gets you through the day. And often people in great pain have a great capacity for humor. And there was a documentary I watched where a burn survivor veteran was doing stand-up comedy, and he stood in front of the audience extremely burned and disfigured from his injuries and let the audience take him in, and then sort of deadpan said, like, you should have seen the other guy. And it's incredible, this self-knowledge about how he was being perceived, how the audience was going to take him in. Humor sort of set them at ease and made everybody feel like they're on the same page. That moment, I was like, if he can make a joke and he can own himself in order to make a joke, nothing is too precious to have a sense of humor about, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an extraordinary example of what everybody should be thinking in any situation where they're the odd man out or they're the underdog, that you sometimes got to call it as it is and then people come to you, they lean into it and say, okay, I see them differently maybe than I see the issue.
Yeah, it like connects you to humanity and all of that.
And that was Ugly Lies the Bone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things was the staging of that, which we didn't get to experience in the reading I saw. But as it went on, there was augmented reality or virtual reality as a part of the therapy. And my understanding from reading about it since is that a lot of that was done in some theatrical way with projection or lighting. So that's a really interesting thing for you to have visualized as a playwright. It was technologically advanced thinking for a play versus a movie.
I purposely wrote it in a way that the only control you have when you're writing a play is putting everything into the dialogue, because they can do the stage directions, cut the stage directions, depending on the budget level, do things at different scales. So when I was writing it, I was aware that for my first production, if I was even so lucky to get it produced, that I was probably not going to get. And the point of it was never to have this like big tech VR heavy thing. I always felt like it was very grounded in reality, even though it's virtual reality. And so the great part about theater is that you can create things that live in the audience's imagination. And so it would be described in the play and felt by the characters, and then the audience can picture whatever they want. And then that has been the exciting part of watching that play be produced in small productions, in big productions, the completely different takes on the VR therapy. When it was done in New York, it was in a fairly small theater, but it had a pretty good budget because it was off Broadway at Roundabout. It was done somewhat minimalist, but there were beautiful projections and lighting changes. I've seen it done in even smaller theaters where they did nothing. And then when it was done at the National Theater, it was the most incredible, high-tech, 3D, unbelievable design. That's the exciting part about writing something like that, is it can be done any sort of way.
How long have you lived in New York City?
Since I moved here for undergrad in 2006.
And do you still have the thrill when you walk down Broadway at night and you see all those marquees and the energy of those stories being told in all those buildings?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, I sort of hate being in Times Square and you get in and out as quickly as possible. But I used to be so moved when I would visit New York and just stand in the center of a theater district. I mean, the fact that there was a whole area of a major city where theater is the main focus of those 10 blocks, I just found that mind-boggling as a young person who lived in Florida. Both yes and no. If I really think about it, yeah, absolutely. But often, like most New Yorkers, you just try to get out of the chaos as quickly as possible.
Right. Do you remember your first New York Times review?
Yes, absolutely.
First of all, I hope it was great because that's very important. But just reading a review of your play in the New York Times, what was that moment like?
Well, it's terrifying. For one, it's terrifying because and there's a whole conversation to be had about whether or not the voice of papers in general, but specifically one paper, they can make or break a career. And that probably is not a great way to, as a culture, judge our reviews are problematic by their very nature. However, I got very lucky. My review of Ugly Lies the Bone was exceedingly positive. And everyone reads reviews. I think people who say they don't are either lying or have the most incredible restraint, self-discipline of I'm not capable. I do end up reading them. I've learned not to read them right away to just like enjoy the evening on opening night. I didn't do that on Ugly Lies the Bone though. And you can sort of sense at an opening night party if the review is good or bad, because if it's bad, people kind of like quietly just leave the party. And if it's good, everyone's jumping up and down. And for Ugly Lies the Bone, it was incredibly positive. And people were jumping up and down at the party and collapsing. And we got critics' pick in the New York Times. And it was particularly kind to me. And the next day, it was on the front page of the art section, and my mom and I went around the city like buying every copy of.
Right, right.
And I think it was a very privileged launch to my career. And I think probably it's not overstating it to say that my career was born in that moment of the New York Times critics pick and all the things that they said about me in particular, which is a scary thing to realize, though, because it could have gone the other way. And that's really just one person's opinion.
No, I understand. And I'm going to share a sentence because I don't think people will necessarily go back and look. But the New York Times said that you write with a muscular empathy, which seeks into the minds of people for whom life is often a struggle of heroic proportions. And so that is an epic sentence. And there was so much else there. But I absolutely know what you mean by it's like you pull it out. And you start by reading a headline and you hope that that at least indicates if it's going to go good or bad. But every word you read the first time you read a review like that is like a guillotine. Is it going to stay up or are they going to chop my head off?
Yeah, I was still a student at Yale when that play was done at the Roundabout. And the first sentence said, I was a brave playwright of dauntless conviction. That was like the quote. And back at Yale, my cohort, my classmates, I couldn't go to the Halloween party because I was in New York doing the show, like the school Halloween party. And they all went as me to the Halloween party and wore mock dresses of what I had worn to my opening and like put the reviews on their Halloween costumes, what the play review was, which was mortifying. But also it was an exciting feeling of one of us was like starting our career.
Yeah. And what a great spontaneous celebration. That costume was not thought of before the reviews arrived, obviously.
No. Yeah. I don't think since then I've had a review that you can make a costume out of. I think they've not been as insanely strong since that first one, but it was a ridiculous moment in time.
I remember the first play that I wrote with another guy named Matt Goldman in Los Angeles. We didn't even know what we were doing. We were two comedians and we wrote a two-man show to showcase some ideas and characters. And we weren't actors, so we didn't really know how to rehearse to do it. And we had a little Hollywood office that we practiced the lines in, but we didn't even know if it was good or bad. We literally couldn't tell because we didn't know what we were doing. So we invited Steve Higgins, who's now the sidekick on the Jimmy Fallon show. But at the time he was just another couch hopping comedian. And we said, Steve, can you come watch this once and give us some notes because we're leaving for Minneapolis tomorrow. We hadn't had anybody look at it.
Yeah.
And at the end of watching us for 75 minutes, he said, I only have one note. There's a groove and you're not in it.
Wow.
And he was absolutely right, but we didn't even know what it meant. We were on the plane going, well, yeah, why is it bad? What are we doing? What's going on? What is this about? And it was such a full note, like this is not good, is what it was saying. And so what was very interesting about it was we now were moving into this production. A few days later, we're doing it for the first time for an audience.
Yeah.
And there's a reviewer there. So now we have to face the show and the overnight wait and see this review. So we do the show and it comes alive with the audience. And what I came to understand, not at the moment, but after the show, is we were comedians and we only knew how to perform for an audience. We didn't know how to rehearse with each other. We didn't know how to stay in the moment. We needed the timing of the laughs. We needed all of that to inform us. So it was an adrenaline-filled night of, well, we survived and we didn't stink it up. But we still didn't know if that review was going to be good or bad. And when it came out in the morning and it said, funniest new kids on the block, we were like, oh, we fooled them. They have no idea what we were doing. But again, it was at that show and with a couple of people in the audience from another theater, the Omaha Playhouse, that was looking for a play. It was the combination of that situation with a review and a performance that moved us into the next box. Every one of these things is a showcase in some way, and the good and the bad both stick with them.
Oh, absolutely. And the problem is, if the reviews are bad, then you just feel bad about yourself. And if the reviews are good, then you feel maybe too good about yourself. I remember writing my next play after getting that review and going like, well, it's a lot to live up to. And that can be a daunting prospect too. So I think the healthier version is probably not to read them at all and just make art for art's sake, but it's very hard to do that.
But I think you are a brave playwright, but I think all playwrights are brave and I think all writers are brave because to me, it's the courage of facing the blank page. Even after success, as you say, topping your last thing is just as hard as writing your first thing. You don't know, and you never know, even on your best day.
Working with Stephen Schwartz, who is such a pro and has been doing this such a long time and has really had success. There are very few people in the world that have had success since they were like 22. It's insane to have such full-on success from such a young age. But Wicked, which is now the longest running show on Broadway, or at least one of the longest running shows on Broadway, didn't particularly get a good review when it first came out, but audiences loved it. They're both meaningful and meaningless.
You should absolutely have the position of not believing the highs or the lows at that point. You still got a job to do. You got to row the boat out and get the sail up and catch the wind, no matter what they say about you. I want folks to know they can find out much more about you by going to lindsayfiorentino.com. You've got a great website that tells people what the history of the past and where you're heading in the future. So appreciate you opening the door to people about what a book writer and a screenwriter has to go through. I say that if the pen is indeed mightier than the sword, that Lindsay Fiorentino is poised to slay any master swordsman that challenges her. I really like watching what's happening for you, and I'm excited about the launch of the new musicals and the new screenplays. So yeah, cheers.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Take a moment to subscribe and we will hold your seat for more creative conversation and a weekly spark of inspiration. Our show is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas, with sound editing and crafty co-producing by Tucker Hazel. The original music theme was created and sung by Maya Sharp, with additional production support and sanity provided by Diane Johansson, Tony Deo, and Tanner Dykstra. Please feel free to dash off a review on social media to help grow this creative community. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, or visit our website at creativityincaptivity.fun. You heard that right, .fun, as in dot was so fun. Bye for now.